First Youth Pink is a not-for-profit ministry of the First Unitarian Church of Des Moines. Support us at ucdsm.org today.
Justice is our theme of the month for October. So what is it? What is justice? We are a hodgepodge of concepts bouncing off each other in patterns that grow into habits of thought. We are also bodies and bodily needs and emotions and emotional triggers and reactivity and ego defense mechanisms, elaborate and complex. We are all of that. But if your body is, for a moment, reasonably well taken care of, if it's fed and rested, reasonably healthy and pain-free, and if conditions are such as to be conducive to being calm and reflective, not consumed by any particular desire, safe, without threats to your well-being or reputation, then what's left of you is a hodgepodge of concepts bouncing off each other in patterns that have formed into habits of thought. And those concepts we carry around, those concepts that constitute us when we're healthy, safe, and calmly reflective, those concepts aren't always all that consistent. And when this is exposed, we experience cognitive dissonance. Still, we might spend a lifetime happily bouncing around among our concepts along greased grooves, oblivious to tensions between them, unless some moral dilemma arises. We might not notice, for instance, that mercy is unjust. I'll make an argument today for the way I think about justice and mercy. My aim, of course, as ever, is not to convince you to agree with me, but to merely give you some fodder for what arguments you might make arranging the concepts that you're bouncing out around among. Mercy seems so benevolent, so kind. Justice seems like a good thing, too. Could two things be at odds with each other and both be good? These concepts we carry around that make up our thought patterns become a part of us, bringing with them a history. And those associations are still with them. Justice, going back to classical times, has to do with people getting what they are due. On the one hand, you're a just person if you give to others what they are due. And on the other hand, you have a basis to ask for justice from others if you don't believe you're getting what you are due. So how do we determine what is due? There's been a lot of variability in that throughout history and from culture to culture and even from one individual to another within the same time and culture, or for that matter, within the same individual from one day to the next. The guideline we have, also going back to classical times, is treat like cases alike. Nothing can happen among people that doesn't have some similarities to something previous that happened. If you can describe an incident with words, those words have meaning because of prior experience with them. And those meanings come with feelings, however vague, and the feelings are either good or bad, however slightly. And that is the ground from which our moral reasoning begins and our moral attitudes take shape. We look for the principles that were followed in other cases and then try to apply those principles to the case at hand. Treat like cases alike. In fact, this basic principle of fairness is common to humans throughout all cultures and times. We find this sense of fairness not only in Homo sapiens, but in hominids, which includes humans, chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas, and orangutans. And not only hominids, but simians, which includes all of the above, plus gibbons and monkeys. Good to know our place in the family of things. Simians have been around 60 million years, while this particular simian, Homo sapiens, has been on this planet less than 300,000. In one study, two capuchin monkeys were in adjacent plexiglass containers. They could see each other. They'd been trained to perform a simple task for which they get a bit of food as a reward. They reach through a hole, hand the human a rock. That's the task. And the human will take the rock and hand them back a bit of food. At first, the food is a piece of cucumber. Cucumber is okay. The monkeys will take the cucumber and eat it. Monkeys will keep performing the task and happily enjoying their cucumber 30 or 40 more times. It's hard to get full on cucumber. But remember, the monkeys can see each other. If after a couple of rounds of doing the task, getting cucumber, monkey A sees monkey B get a grape in exchange for performing the task, monkey A notices. Monkey A apparently is thinking, great, we're getting grapes now. For a capuchin monkey, a bit of cucumber is okay, but a grape is mwah. So if monkey A hands the human a rock and gets back only another bit of cucumber, there's going to be some protest about that. They don't speak English, but it's clear what the content of the protest is. That's not fair! He got a grape! Where's my grape? The slighted monkey will become agitated and howl. You can watch this on YouTube when you get home. Go to YouTube, type in monkey grape cucumber. And you'll see that the monkey takes that bit of cucumber and throws it back at the human. The cucumber, which a minute before had been perfectly acceptable, is now despised. Similar experiments have been tried with dogs and some bird species, and they found similar results. Treat like cases alike. It's a very deep principle. If I do the same task as someone else and there's payment for it, I want the same payment. The need to be treated fairly is a deep need, going beyond even our species. We can calmly accept deprivation if others are too. So, justice. Giving people what they are due and treating like cases alike. What is due might be a better shake. When we talk about justice to racial groups or women or to workers or to the poor, we're talking about treating them better. But what is due might be punishment. If someone's done wrong, we want them punished. I've noticed some shift in recent years toward avoiding the word punishment a little more. When people object to police abuse, for instance, they rarely say abusive officers should be punished. The preferred language seems to be abusive officers should be held accountable. Accountability could take the form of punishment, and that's the form that usually seems to be implied. But I do appreciate leaving the door open for non-punitive forms of accountability. The movement for restorative justice is all about accountability and restoring relationships, but without jail or prison or heavy fines. Still, some cases arise that reveal a felt need to punish goes deep in at least us humans. The case of George Tyndall was a reminder of that this week. George Tyndall was a former gynecologist at USC accused of sexual misconduct toward a generation of women students at USC. The university earlier had paid out $1.1 billion in settlement, the largest in higher education history, and Tyndall was set to stand trial on sex crimes stemming from his treatment of 16 former patients, a subset of hundreds of women who had accused him of inappropriate touching, harassment, and other misconduct during a tenure at the campus health clinic that stretched back from the late 1980s to 2016. And then George Tyndall, out on bail, died in his home a little more than a week ago. This was profoundly unsatisfying for some of his victims. Many of his accusers felt that his death allowed him to avoid justice. They didn't want Tyndall dead. They wanted him punished, even if some of them might have wanted the death penalty for him. And I don't know that any of them did, but if they had, what they would be wanting would be death as punishment, not death from natural causes. which is what the coroner reported and which felt like cheating his way out of the punishment that would have represented justice. The felt need for punishment runs deep. And what makes punishment punishment and not simply a mishap or natural causes is that it's deliberately inflicted by the agents of social order for the sake of social order. In the family, those agents are the parents who might punish a child for the sake of family social order and mores. In the state, those agents are called our justice system. In practice, of course, our penal system today does more damage to social order than it does good, but the ideal that wrongdoing should be punished, that is, that the perpetrator should endure unpleasant consequences inflicted by some authority, either human or divine, seen as overseeing our collective well-being, that idea is deeply a part of us. It's in there. Determining what punishment is due involves an evolving system of trying to treat like cases alike. Relevantly similar crimes, we feel, should get relevantly similar punishment. Of course, there's slippage around the notion of relevantly similar. If two men in separate incidents have each stolen a loaf of bread, and one of them is starving and trying to feed a family that is starving, while the other is reasonably well fed and had the money to buy the bread and just didn't want to spend it, many of us would call that a morally relevant difference. Javert, in Victor Hugo's Les Misérables, didn't think it was a morally relevant difference, and he pursues Jean Valjean accordingly. So that's a sketch of some of the ways our concept of justice bounces around in our thought patterns. What then about mercy? Do we say that Jean Valjean should get mercy, even though he did steal the bread, or do we say, forget mercy, our principles of justice themselves should be adjusted? What then about mercy? Do we say that Jean Valjean should get mercy even though he did steal that bread? Or do we say, forget about mercy, our principles of justice themselves should be adjusted? We should understand that justice itself takes into account extenuating circumstances. So, do we then need a concept of mercy at all? Justice may call for punishment, but mercy would let you off the hook. That's the situation that Shakespeare presents to us in The Merchant of Venice. As Elizabeth reviewed for us in the reading, Antonio offers a pound of his flesh closest his heart as guarantee of a loan. When the loan is not repaid, Shylock claims his pound of flesh. Portia then tells Shylock he must be merciful, and Shylock retorts, "On what compulsion must I? Tell me that." Portia famously replies, "The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed, blessing him that gives and him that takes." Not strained is short for not constrained, meaning that we cannot be constrained to be merciful. Mercy can't be compelled. If it's compelled, it isn't mercy. Shylock asks, "On what compulsion must I be merciful?" And the answer is, there is no compulsion. It's not about compulsion. Justice is about compulsion. There are principles of fairness that rightfully do constrain our behavior. But mercy doesn't work that way. Mercy just happens, the way gentle rain falls on the ground. And when it does, it blesses both giver and receiver. So, mercy is what we call it when we are spared from what we deserve. A few lines later, Portia makes the point, "In the course of justice, none of us should see salvation." Wait, what? None? Okay, I think I see our problem here. If justice is understood as that which, strictly adhered to, condemns us all, then we need a new conception of justice. Alas, the idea that we all deserve damnation is our Western heritage. Theologians and priests for centuries emphasized what sinners we are. They gave us a picture of ourselves as fundamentally corrupt at our core. Every one of us is so profoundly, inherently sinful that if we got what we deserved, we'd all be thrown to the worst punishment we can imagine. So, mercy enters the picture.
No one is good enough to deserve going to heaven on their own merits, but some people get in just because of God's benevolent mercy. The Church has generally avoided stating precisely how many would receive this grace. The Jehovah's Witnesses are an exception. They teach that exactly 144,000 faithful Christians will go to heaven to rule with Christ in the kingdom of God. Mostly, only a rough sense of the proportions was indicated. In John Calvin's theology, for instance, it seems like very few. I get the impression from Calvin that he imagines maybe something around 2% of all people will get to heaven. Our forebears, the Universalists, taught that God's benevolent mercy extends to all. Every person will go to heaven. We get our name, Universalists, from this doctrine of universal salvation. But even the Universalists, for the most part, didn't think people deserved it or had earned it. Justice would condemn, but God's mercy saves. On that point, the Calvinists and the Universalists agreed. They merely disagreed on how many of us God's mercy saves. Through the 20th century, Unitarians and Universalists slowly shed the sense that sin, inner corruption, was humanity's essential feature. Instead, we began to see human suffering in terms of disconnection. The deprivation in lower classes and alienation in any class that accompanies uprootedness from healthy community of care, respect, meaning, and opportunity. We stand, as ever, in need of justice, but not justice in the course of which none of us should see salvation, but justice as the construction of fairness in the face of oppressions that undermine community, justice as healing the wounds of separation, justice as the restoration of belonging. If we have real justice in this way, then we could do without mercy. Mercy, like justice, has historically had a variety of meanings. Sometimes mercy is used to mean compassion and kindness, and we can certainly use that. Our hearts long for compassion, kindness, caring, both to give it and receive it. But mercy, taken as a decision to deviate from the requirements of justice, perhaps we could do without. Justice is principled. It follows principles. If there are rules governing the case at hand, justice follows the rules. If there are no clear rules, justice weighs the principles. Mercy, however, flouts all rules and principles. Mercy is necessarily unprincipled. Principles define justice, and mercy is deviation from justice and its principles. We might indeed think that our principles of justice need to be more compassionate, less draconian. But as long as they are principles, that is, they apply to all like cases, then they are matters of deciding what justice is, not matters of deciding when to forgo justice for the sake of something called mercy. If a judge is merciful to one convicted defendant, but not to others, that's not fair. And if the judge is merciful to all of them, then that's not mercy. It's just that judge's rules of procedure. Too much mercy, and there's no enforcement of justice at all. If contracts are never enforced, no one will enter into contracts, including ultimately the social contract, and society falls apart. If our children or we ourselves are always spared any unpleasant consequences of our actions, we won't learn or won't maintain the skills and habits of responsibility. Nothing emboldens sin so much as mercy. Shakespeare has a character say in one of his lesser-known plays, Timon of Athens, making counterpoint to Portia in Merchant of Venice. Mercy is utterly capricious, and we should be suspicious of it, not just because it is abstractly unjust, but because caprice tends to favor the already privileged. In our schools, for instance, black students are more likely than white students to be referred for disciplinary action for subjective infractions such as disruption or defiance. Across the board, black students tend to experience harsher disciplinary measures at higher rates than their peers in public schools in the United States. Black students are 4 times more likely to experience suspension than their white peers. Mercy, it seems, extends to the pale-skinned. As mercy overrides the principles that would apply to everyone, what determines when mercy is extended? When the principles which constitute justice are overthrown, what's left are our implicit unspoken biases, including implicit racial biases. Now, before I conclude that we ought to just dispense with the very idea of mercy, that what we need is greater clarity on principles of justice, and that we should then simply live by those principles, I want to acknowledge what I find to be a fairly compelling case for sometimes, indeed, tossing out rules and principles and reasons. Back in 1985, California writer Ann Herbert wrote an article for the Whole Earth Review titled "Random Kindness and Senseless Acts of Beauty." The phrase caught on. Probably you have heard it. It cleverly turned on its head a phrase we had all heard too much in the news: random violence and senseless acts of brutality. What a lovely thing to instead practice random kindness and senseless acts of beauty. Herbert writes in her original 1985 article, "Anything you think there should be more of, do it randomly. Don't await a reason. It will make itself be more senselessly. Scrawl it on the wall, random kindness and senseless acts of beauty." I used to have fantasies of positive vandalism, breaking into the school at night and painting a dirty room bright colors overnight, fixing broken glass in people's houses while they're gone, leaving full meals on tables in the struggling part of town. End quote. And that really does sound lovely. And what makes that kind of random kindness different from mercy's capriciousness is that mercy is something bestowed by someone in a position of power, whether divine or human, like school authorities deciding whether to suspend a student, or a criminal court judge pronouncing sentence upon the convicted. A soldier victorious in battle might or might not show mercy to the vanquished. A person of wealth who controls resources that can make or break another's livelihood may choose to be merciful. Another way of saying that mercy is uncompelled and unconstrained is to say the option of mercy arises from being in a position of power in relation to someone else. Hence, Portia says, it is mightiest in the mighty. So that's the conclusion I leave you with today. My argument is that compassion and kindness, caring and love are the greatest forces and the highest achievements humanity can strive for. But if we get justice right, then we will have no need for a concept of mercy that is in any way distinct from compassion and kindness. And if you're not in a position of exercising power over, then some randomness, some caprice, just following the whims of impulses to kindness can also be a beautiful thing. Blessing indeed, the one that gives and the one that takes. May it be so. Blessed be. Amen.